the fastest, quickest, smoothest footwork. He is the Fred Astaire of jiu-jitsu, the Fred Astaire of judo, but he's the Dom DeLuise of pizza eating. I don't get it. I don't get this.
Everybody wake up.
Time to wake up. Time to start the day. Wake up late with Dougie. He is the only
wake
way.
Wake up late. Now everybody. Wake up late. Everybody. Wake up late. Wake up late.
Wake up.
Wake up late with Dougie. Wake up late with Dougie. Wake up late with Dougie.
It's time to wake up.
Wake up late with Dougie. What rhymes with Dougie? He's just so funny.
It's the Wake Up Late with Dougie show. Live from Danger Studios. Coral Springs, and now you know.
We're the hottest show in this place. Wake up late now, everybody. Wake up late now, everybody. Wake up late now, everybody.
I said one, two, three. Everybody wake up.
Live from Danger Studios in Coral Springs, Florida. It's the Wake Up Late with Dougie show. Starring Dougie Almeida. Now. Let's start the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Wake Up Late with Dougie show. This is Dougie Almeida, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm joined by my co-host, the beautiful and funny Jen Hellman.
Hello, everybody. Good to see you all.
Absolutely.
See anyone? Somehow.
And I can tell you, extremely excited and honored to have our special guest on today, comedy icon and legend, Tom Dreesen, everybody. Welcome, Tom.
I hear all the clapping.
Whenever somebody calls you a legend, I always think you become a legend when you've outlived all your critics. They're all dead. You've been around so long that you don't have the critics all die, so you can become a legend. And
I almost didn't want to use it because legend means you're close to the grave, and you are timeless, my friend. You are one of those. You are one of those folks that are timeless. You got great hair. You look great. You're always in shape. You were just a, you know, you were just a, you're just a perfect man.
Wow. I've never heard him say that about anyone.
I got to tell you, I hope there's a lot of women I've known in my life that will say, did he just say that Dreesen is a perfect man?
He said it. I'm your witness.
You know what, though? I have to tell you about being a stand-up comedian. You know, it's almost like playing in a major leagues. You've got to stay in shape if you're going to stay out there. You can't drugs and alcohol and drinking, especially in the days of opening for Frank, when you're going out in front of 20,000 people in an arena, you can't go out there with hangovers and bad shape and you know, eating poorly. So it became like I ran marathons. I trained for marathons in my life. But it came like that comedy is the same way. You got to, if you're going to do this for a long period of time, you got to stay in shape, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow. I don't think a lot of comedians got that memo that we know. That
Well, my point is, when you walk out there, if you don't feel good about yourself, you know what I mean? And that'll come true to the audience sometimes. You got to. And by the way, it's like an exercise when you walk out there in front of all those people in the round and you're working this part of the stage and that part of the stage. You know, I think you have to not only stay in shape, but you got to feel good about yourself, you know.
Undoubtedly. I mean, there's got to be. Obviously, the most people I think I've ever performed in front of was 1,500 people at the Broward Convention Center during a mayor's gala ball, but 20,000 people. I mean, first of all, your timing has to be much different, right? You can't go out there and just be quick talking. I mean, there's got to be a major adjustment.
Major, and you know, when I say this all the time. And by the way, I worked in front of 40,000 people in Hawaii one time with Frank. It was on a big outdoor thing, but. You know, if I did a 30-minute set tonight at the Laugh Factory and I did this 30-minute set and then I took that same 30-minute set, the same material in front of 20,000 people, that same material takes on a totally different dynamic now, you know, because if you dissect comedy, it gets boring. But I always, you know, we set our timing off of their laughter. I always make the analogy that say there's a pond of water in front of you and you got a rock and you throw that rock as high as you can in the air and it goes as high as it can and then it starts slowly coming down and it hits the pond and ripples across the pond. Say that's laughter. You know you don't move on that line when that laughter is on its way up. But some nights when I'm out there, it's starting to come down a little bit and I move. Sometimes it's coming down halfway and I move. Sometimes I let it hit the pond before I move. Some nights I let it hit the pond and ripple all the way across. before I move. I can't tell you that before I go out there because I don't know. It's reading the audience. And you know, so I tell young comedians all the time, I can teach you a lot about stand-up comedy, and I do. I give classes and stuff. I can't teach you timing. You either have it or you don't, you know, and timing is so essential. And like I say, that same material in front of 20,000 people, and by the way, they're behind you too. So you're in the round. So you got to work all parts of that stage and, you know, and that laughter goes up and it comes down. And some nights, like I say, if they're not giving me what I think, I move quicker. I move quicker. Some nights, if they're giving me a lot, I move slow. And some nights, when they're really giving me a lot, I let it roll all the way. But again, I don't write that down before I go out there. I don't know till it happens, as you know.
Yeah, you just get a feel for it, right? You got to work on your feet. And, sure. And based on what I read now, first of all, let me say this. If you haven't already, you have to go on Amazon and get Tom's latest book, Still Standing. And I mentioned to you guys in our pre-show that my wife was shocked that I was actually reading a book. you know, she didn't know what it was. She thought it was like just pictures, as Jen said, of just naked women in there. And there aren't, unfortunately. But you got to get it because first, and we're going to get into this. You have a storied life. I mean, I can remember as a child, when I was young lad, my parents would stay up late watching Johnny Carson. You know, they were not early bird. You know, they didn't go to bed early. They would be up late at night, and I'd be laying on the couch as a young man watching Johnny Carson. So he got to watch all this. I'm jumping here, but you got a great story about Johnny Carson in the book too, which I thought was amazing. And I don't want to give away anything to the book, but so I'm gonna kind of gloss over things. And if you want to let it out, but it's amazing from day one. The book starts off with you in Harvey, Illinois, as a young man. And I learned the difference between tavern and saloon, or tavern and a bar, because that's where you grew up in.
Yeah. Yeah, there were Harvey, Illinois is a suburb on the south side of Chicago. It had steel mills and factories, a lot of factories. They made everything from clutch plates to crankshafts, and it was just a blue-collar town. And I shined shoes in all the taverns. We had 36 taverns in Harvey. There were 8 in my neighborhood. And I had 8 brothers and sisters. We lived in a shack. It was raggedy poor. If a window broke, you stuck a rag in it. If you got holes in your shoes, you put cardboard in it, you know. And I would go, to the bars every night, shining shoes in all the bars and while I was on my hands and knees shining shoes in the bars, Frank Sinatra was on the jukebox. And that's basically, the book is that journey from that little boy. And by the way, to digress, all my career, I've viewed the world from that little boy. When I was flying with Frank's private jet or doing the Tonight Shows or appearing in Las Vegas and all these places, I was only a heartbeat away from that little boy. There were nights that I would almost pinch myself, but I viewed the whole world from that little kid carrying that shoeshine box. If I close my eyes today, I can see him carrying the shoeshine box, trudging through the snow, going from bar to bar, trying to make some money to help feed his brothers and sisters. And none of this do I regret, by the way. But again, Frank was on the jukebox. It's the first time I heard him. And then years later, fast forward, I'm carrying Frank Sinatra's coffin out of a church in Beverly Hills, California. And so it's that book is about that and all the things that happened in between, you know, your comedians, the ups and downs, the hardships, the rejections. And man, I had a closet full of those. And still standing is a double entendre. I've been a stand-up comedian for 50 years, but I've been knocked down a lot in my life. And physically, as you know, in the book, you read it, Dougie, physically knocked down. But I'm still standing. And that's the message, that you don't give up. We're warriors. Comedians are warriors. Yeah. You know, and I'll go one more step further. When I was in the service, you bonded with these guys because you knew if the shit hit the fan. Can I say that? Can I swear?
Yes, we prefer it.
You had my back.
Okay to do it now.
You know, but you had my back, and so we've been through some skirmishes, and so I knew you had my back. When I meet with comedians now, even if I've never met them before, my heart goes in because I know what they've gone through and they're still going through. You know. We're like seasoned veterans. After about 10, 20, 30 years in this business, you've been rejected. I told you were not funny, told you were the funniest thing in the world, and told you, you know, you're not funny at all. You've been up for parts that you didn't get. You've been, you know, had club owners who liked you and other club owners who would never hire you again. It's all those ups and downs that we bond, we comedians. By the way, and when we get together after the shows, all the comedians, we don't want to hear about that standing ovation you got.
No.
You know, the time you bombed, you know, tell me when you, Dougie, oh, yeah, that night I didn't get one laugh. And, oh, yeah, tell us some more.
Let's talk about the woman giving us cow eyes in the front row. Let's talk about her.
Yeah.
Did you have a backup plan? So when you were embarked on the journey as being a comedian, did you have a backup plan, or you were just riding this out to wherever it was going to take you?
It was do or die. I once read a thing when I made up my mind. The first time I ever went on stage, I never thought I'd be a comedian. It was the furthest thing from my mind. I never dreamed I'd ever be a comedian. But the first time I went on stage with Tim Reed, we were America's first black and white comedy team. History shows we were the last. But I wrote something that first night on stage, it got a laugh. And when it got a laugh, it was like one of those epiphanies where like a B movie where the dark clouds open up and the sun bursts through and my whole being went, yeah, oh yeah, this is what I want to do. I've been praying. I've been honestly praying, saying, God, what is it I'm supposed to be doing? Because I'm saying I don't belong here, but I didn't know where I belong. So when I got that comedy bug, I knew from that moment nothing was going to stop me. I don't care what happened. And I read a book one time. It was the Greek mythology where this Greek admiral had two ships, and he had a total of about 1,200 men in the two ships. And the enemy on the island, there was 10,000 of his enemy. And when they embarked on the shores, he told them, look back. He had set fire to both ships. He said, now we have to win.
Yeah.
And they won. So I burned all the ships behind me. And I said, now I have to win. And I wasn't going to give up this dream. And I'm doing blabbing here, but Bertrand Russell once said the most profound thing. He said, there are people in show business who become major stars simply because they didn't have sense enough to quit when they should have.
I mean, like you said, it's a rough road. I mean, that's always the thing that differentiates the successful from those who don't succeed, you know, dealing with adversity, handling it and not letting it like define you. Right. I mean, you're right. I mean, you have a show one day where you're getting an applause breaks and you think you're the greatest person in the world. The next show you're standing there greeting people and like somebody walks by and goes, yeah, keep it up, buddy. Keep working at it. Look,
Dick Shawn, years ago, a comedian said, people live from day to day, singers live from song to song, and comedians live from joke to joke. Your options up at the end of every joke, you know.
Yeah. I think one of the most amazing elements, though, that from the time when you started comedy, because you didn't have social media, you people who made it in comedy like yourself during that time, you were validated because you were funny. You couldn't get where you were unless you were funny. And now we have this competitive arena of comedians who maybe like went to an open mic at one of the big clubs and they got a picture in front of the sign and they got people to follow them. And whereas maybe they're fundamentally mediocre at best at comedy, they're building knowing themselves on social media. And then for some of the people who are better at talent and worse at social media, or they're falling through the cracks. It's so nice that you come from a time where like I said, you had to be, what was validated was being good. You weren't competing with one-nighters. You couldn't promote a one-nighter comedy show somewhere. You had to go out and hand it. Did you ever do that? Do you ever have to go out and hand out the tickets and try to get people to come into the show?
No, when I saw that in Times Square, I was doing Letterman's show like 3-4 times a year, and I'd go walking around Times Square. And I would see these young kids doing that. And my heart ached for them. But I also said, I would have done the same thing. I would have done the same thing. You know, if that's what it took to get up on stage, and I would have done the same thing. The difference between today and my era, in 1975, everywhere you went in America, people say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. The next question out of their mouth was, oh yeah, have you ever been on Johnny Carson? And if you had been on Johnny Carson in the eyes of America, you just weren't a comedian. So there was a path to, I hate to say stardom, because ever since I toured with Frank Sinatra, if somebody said, oh, you're a star, I'm not a star. I met a star. I travel with a star. So my point is, but the path to success as a comedian was a Tonight Show. There was a distinct path. One appearance on the Tonight Show, Freddie Prinze got a sitcom the next day. I did one appearance on the Tonight Show. The next day, CBS signed me to a development deal. A guy named Lee Curlin from New York was watching the show that night, and he signed me to a development deal. I was broke on my ass. I had a wife and three kids. there was no money coming in, and my rent was $225 a month for a 3-bedroom apartment in Van Nuys, and I couldn't make rent money. And the next day, my whole life changed. They signed me to a development deal. I never stopped working since that first appearance on the Tonight Show. But it was the stamp of approval. And if you did one appearance on the Tonight Show, to America, you had arrived. But you hadn't arrived to my industry, to our industry, till you sat down and talked to Johnny. When Johnny called you over, like, say, the third time, that's when you had arrived. And 26 million people watched that show in those days.
Yeah.
Sorry, Doug, go ahead.
Well, what I want to say here is that, you know, in our business, we have haters. I think that's always existed. And, you know, somebody would say, oh, he got lucky, he got on the Tonight Show. But here's the thing, and I'll bring this up. This when you talk about first, your first goal wasn't to get into the, on the, well, it would have been the goal, but your first goal was to get to the Comedy Store. Your first goal was to get in an area where you're going to be seen. That was advice to you. Somebody said, you're not going to make it big, you know, doing stand up here and there. And then, you know, great story about how your friend let her stay there and you almost beat up her boyfriend staying at the house. But you lived in a car. I mean, this is dedication. You lived in a car solely for the purpose of getting stage time at the Comedy Store.
Yeah. It wasn't my car. It was a Nash Rambler up on blocks.
Yeah.
and when she threw me out, you know, because her boyfriend thought we were having an affair and we weren't, you know, I mean, and I was trying to tell him that no, she was just being nice to me and let me stay there. And he was one of those insane, crazy, jealous guys. And I kept pleading with the guy, please don't be angry at her. It's not what you think. And then finally, you know, well, you read the book, you know, finally I lost it and said, okay, now you want to fight? Okay. I've tried to tell you she's a decent person, but you can't accept that because of your sick mind. So let's go out in the alley and I'm going to beat the bejesus out of you.
That's one thing a lot of people may not know, that you are a scrapper. You're a tough guy, man. You're not gonna take shit from someone.
Well, I'm embarrassed with that because I don't think of myself as a tough guy. I boxed when I was in the Navy, and I grew up in the streets. You know, I don't have a degree from academia, but I got a doctorate from the streets. And where I grew up, they solved everything by going outside. You know, in every bar, you know. I think those Cubs of yours suck. Yeah, outside, pal. And they brought me each other, you know. But you know what? But also, because I grew up on the streets, I know when you're joking with me, and I know when you're trying to put me down, and I know when you're trying to take advantage of me, you know, and of your good nature. So anyhow, that's neither here nor there. But I think that the reason that all of us survive is because in comedy is because, like I said earlier, we're warriors. We are scrappers. You know, stand-up comedy is the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. Sure. When it works, oh man, there's no describing that the material you wrote that day and that laughter that comes back to you. You know, we're artists. We are artists. You know, the most artists who paint, like the painting behind me, sometimes they don't know if their art is approved until after they're dead. We get instant approval. We write the joke that day. We go on stage that night. It gets a laugh. Bingo. Nothing feels better than that. But when it doesn't work, it's the lowest of lows. You know, we expose ourselves. We're naked. There's no fourth wall like in acting, putting up that fourth wall. We break that fourth wall. And you know what? They don't say, if they see an actor, they'll say, well, I didn't like him in that role. You know, I didn't like Bobby De Niro in that role or something. A singer, they'll say, oh, he's a good singer, but I didn't like that particular song. In comedy, they say, I saw Tom Dreesen. I don't like him.
I don't like him. Yeah, I agree. I mean, that is the difference. Even in the music, I don't like you said, I don't like that song. When we take rejection, we're opening up there. The best comedy is when we talk about ourselves and we open this vulnerable thing, and for them to not accept it, I mean, we'd have to be sick. We are. I think there's a sickness in us that is actually addicted to feeling this way.
Well, I, you know, Carl Reiner once told me many years ago, he said, Tom, you're going to be a stand-up comedian all your life. Show me your pain. They love to see your pain. But I think what he meant was be vulnerable. You know, comedy writers would say to me sometimes, you know, I want to write comedy. You know, what should I write about if I write for a stand-up? I said, what pisses you off?
Yeah.
What pisses you off is good comedy, you know. That sort of thing. You know? Yeah, we're, you know, I always thought, and Dougie, you and Jen can give me your opinion. But 50 years I've been doing this, 85% of all stand-up comedians that I've met are insecure, neurotic, sometimes psychotic, loved, starved, wrecks, absolute wrecks. And the other 15% are gifted, confident people who say, I know how to write a joke and I know how to tell a joke. And I like to think that I'm in the latter, but never trust somebody that tells you they're sane. You know?
Yeah. I mean, how true is that? I mean, because it's devastating, you know, because I've had people bring this up to me, mentors of mine, about the industry, about how bipolar it can be. And that's why you see a lot of, you know, folks that, you know, that commit suicide in this business, you know, because it's you're opening Pandora's box. When you make that many people laugh, when you feel that type of pleasure, when you get that exhilaration, to find it again, you know, you really got to be back. And as a comic, that's what it's all about. It's about getting booked. It's about getting more work. It's about just keep moving on. And I could tell you that with this whole pandemic thing going on, it's been brutal when you don't have a show for 2 weeks. You know, it's like,
well, 2 weeks. I haven't had a show in 6 months. Oh. We haven't worked in 6 months. All my gigs canceled, you know. It's hard to describe. I've known 5 stand-up comedians who committed suicide and another 25 that let drugs and alcohol destroy them.
Sure.
And these are funny people. Richard Jenny was one of the funniest human beings I ever met in my life. Richard Jenny was the most prolific stand-up comic. I love watching him work. Richard Jenny could do 30 minutes, laugh after you go outside, sit in the car and come back with another 30 minutes. His material is just classic, you know, and he killed himself. Robin Williams, Freddie Prinze, of course, Steve Levitkin, who we write about in the book, you know. You're walking a tightrope out there every night, you know. You're going out to perfect strangers every night and saying, love me. Now, by the way, once you're established and people come to see you, that's a whole different ballgame. When you walk out and say you sell 250 tickets and they came to see you, now that's fun because they're your audience, you know. But it's when you're new and you're starting out and every night you're asking strangers, love me. I want you to like me. Because they got to like you before they'll laugh at you. You know, that's why your opening material is when you're brand new. It's very important to start out telling them about you, where you're from, where, you know, your mom and dad, your brothers and sisters. The first 6 or 8 minutes, you're making them laugh, introducing yourself to them. So when they walk away, they say, gee, wasn't he funny? And he came from Harvey, Illinois, and that's where his accent, he's from the south side of Chicago. And he had 8 brothers and sisters, and, you know, and he went to Catholic school, and he played basketball on an all-black basketball team. You left part of you out there. Later on, when you're established, you can walk out and your first joke could be about the government or the airlines, you know, because they know who you are. But when you're new, you got to introduce yourself with comedy material to the audience.
That's important. A lot of new comics, you know, like anything, like when you learn a new language, you learn the dirty words. And a lot of new comics, you learn dirty jokes. And, you know, when we talked a lot of comics at open mics and stuff, they're always like, why can't I be dirty? I'm like, look, you can do whatever you want. I'm just saying that, you know, you're probably going to get a lot more work as a clean comic, and it's definitely a lot more challenging to write. Being in the business 50 years, are you still writing? Do you still grab a pen and paper and start writing some jokes?
Yeah, you know what I do? I've always done this. Like, if I'm on the golf course, and I'll have pencil and paper there. Or now today, you use your cell phone. If I'm on an airplane, the thought comes to me, I just scribble it down, and I'll longhand it. Later, I'll go, like, I'll have, like, wads of paper and notes, and then some nights when I'm in the mood, used to be in the old days, it was the necessity. You know, I had to come up with new material all the time. Oh, I did 61 appearances on The Tonight Show. Every time you did The Tonight Show, you had to do a new 6 minutes. So, and I did 61 appearances on it. So I was always in a state of writing new material. But I have to be in the mood anymore. I'll take all my notes and I'll longhand the joke, you know. When you're writing a joke, it's, you know, comedy is 2 things. Number one, it's 9/10 surprise. 9/10 surprise. The audience laughs because they didn't think you were going to say that or do that. So the setup line has to hide the punchline. And the other rule is there are no victimless jokes. Who's the victim here? You know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like in the beginning, yeah, like I like to use self-deprecating humor in the beginning, you know, make fun of myself because I'm going to be make fun of others. So I want to make sure I cover myself first and everything. But you're right.
Very smart, by the way. Open with the joke is on you. The first couple of jokes are on you. That's very smart. You know,
well, as someone who's every joke is on her. I mean, like I have a very self-deprecating act, not, and again, for women, I see a lot of women go right to the easy laugh with the dirty jokes. And it just breaks my heart because I think there is an audience for that. But even for myself growing up, I mean, you should want your comedy to be cerebral. It's smart and it's intelligent, and women have this amazing capability of delivering that, and you don't expect it. But sure enough, the first thing women do is start telling dirty jokes. Fortunately, I was told very early on and directed away from that. I don't even really think that dirty anyway. In comedy, but I think it's just for my own influences. Though I grew up watching, you know, Ellen DeGeneres and Elaine Boozler and Rita Rudner.
Elaine Boozler. Elaine Boozler. Yeah. Wonderful at that.
Yeah. Elaine Boozler was great, and you know, Joan Rivers, she was edgy, she was funny, but very self-deprecating. I would say she was probably one of my biggest influences. And it's so much fun. It's for me. It's like I've looked at comedy. And you know, you might be like this too. I feel like a lot of comedians don't like the public. So like, I love people. I can sit down with any person one-to-one and just be like, what's your story? Oh yeah, where'd you come from? Oh, that's interesting. Put me in an airport. I want to blow them all away. So comedy has been this thing where I can connect with people, but in a public format, and it's driven by what's wrong with me. And it's so much fun. It's so, you know, I think self-deprecation is definitely one of the best things that you're talking, and it's original. You can keep it, you know, if you're talking about yourself, it's going to be original. But have you found, you know, connecting, were you somebody who would like to stay and talk to people after a show, or are you like in the car and back to the hotel?
No, you know, I'm like you. I'm a people person. I was a bartender. I had eight brothers and sisters. I'm a people person. I light up around people. You know, to be honest, I was thinking about the other day, if I'm feeling punky or not feeling real good, you know, if I go out and start talking to somebody, I feel terrific. I'm a people person. I like being around people, you know. I got to tell you something interesting. We were talking about blue material. You know, I tell all the new comedians, if you can, write your first hour clean. And then if you want to go blue, you know, work dirty, that's okay. But I was at the Laugh Factory a while back, and I was upstairs. I was going to try out some new material, and there was two young comedians on the other side. They didn't know I was there, and I didn't know they were there. But one of them said, I was looking at my notes, and one of them said, you know, Tom Dreesen's here tonight. So I perked up, you know, and the other comedian said, oh yeah, you know, he's old school. And the other comedian said, he's old school? What do you mean? He said, well, he doesn't use the F word. The other comedian said, he doesn't use the F word. What does he use for adjectives? And I stuck my head around the corner. And I said, adjectives. That's what I use for adjectives. Adjectives. You know. But I thought that was so funny, you know. But you know, by the way, I'm a street guy. I can do a stag roast with the best of them, and I've done the stag roast. You know, I can be as, but if we're in show business, that's two words, show and business. When I started out, how do you get to the Tonight Show? Everybody, that's what we could launch you. So you know, as a businessman, you're looking at it. Oh, you watch the Tonight Show and see what comedians were on there, David Brenner and all those guys, what they were doing. Oh, I see. You had the right material that could make grandma and grandpa, mom and dad and the kids laugh. So that's what you had to focus on. Now, so once I start doing that and I start doing a lot of Tonight Shows, now I'm being called on. In those days, In Las Vegas or anywhere around the country, all the theaters and around and everything, these singers all wanted comedians to open for them, you know. And so, but all had family audiences. I toured with Gladys Knight and the Pips and Natalie Cole and Tony Orlando and Dawn and Frankie Avalon and James Nairn. I toured with Smokey Robinson and Mac Davis and Sammy Davis after a while. And then, of course, Frank. And there were family people in the audience. So they couldn't have a blue comedian. They wouldn't hire you. But because they saw me on TV doing all this working clean, I got a lot of work. And then corporate America. You know, many agents said they lost their client. They had IBM, they had AT&T or American Airlines. They lost the client because they hired a comedian that started swearing and blew, and it offended somebody in the audience. So they called it the SAFE Act. They'd say, Dreesen's safe. In other words, you're not going to lose their client, you know. But there was more money. Think about this. You're going to go work a comedy club. You can work as blue as you want. and you're going to work there today. I'll just throw a figure. I don't know what you make for a week there. I've never worked comedy clubs like that, but say you make $2,500 or something. I don't know. Say you get $2,500 for Thursday, Friday, Saturday. If you're even, you draw somewhat, you can go do a corporate date and get $20,000 for 45 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard about those.
it's funny you should say that. I got the comedy bug when I was a spokesman for Hartford Financial. I'm a financial advisor of 30 years. So I would do these seminars in front of like 300, 400 people talking about annuities and life insurance and all those things. And I actually got let go because I wouldn't stick to the script because I would like to be funny. I'd like to make it entertaining and stuff like that. And you're right. I mean, yeah, I've got an outline for a book, you know, I Mean No Harm and The Funny Fiduciary. But you're right. I have a good buddy of mine, Mike Rivera, who was the funniest teacher. And he wrote a book and he goes and does all these corporate gigs with teachers. And you know, there's a lot of great comics. I know that they you may not know them in the scene, but they'll work a comedy club, like you said, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, Thursday through Saturday, make a couple hundred, make a couple grand, whatever, 1500. But then they'll do one gig on that Wednesday afternoon at a corporate show and get 10 grand. And then they'll be able to sell their book to every other place. Oh, we got 100 people who will buy a book for everybody, you know, and boom, you know, absolutely. You got to work smart, you know?
Yeah, I mean, well, again, we're in show business. That's two words, show and business. You know, I'll tell you a great story. Frank Sinatra told me, I never forgot this. He was telling me when we were riding around the desert, he stayed up till dawn. He never would go to bed till the sun came up. And I was staying at his house. He has this big compound down in Rancho Mirage. And, anyhow, we'd ride around till dawn. And he was telling me this story. He said, Tommy, there was a time when I was the hottest thing in the country. Tommy, he said, I was so hot that I could call any recording company, any heads of studios, any agent, any manager. He said, and they'd take my call. He said, Tom, I could call the president of the United States and they would take my call. He said, and then I got cold, real cold, and I couldn't get anyone to take my call. He said, 3 years go by and I got hot again from the movie From Here to Eternity. You know, he said, I got hot again. He said, and I'd go out to a social event and I'd see one of those guys that wouldn't take my call. And I look across the room at him, and he couldn't look me in the eye. He'd look down. And he said, but what he didn't understand is now I understood. We're in show business. Two words, show and business. I couldn't do business for him. That's why he didn't take my call. He said, it was my fault. I thought we were friends. What a profound line that is.
You know, when I was 30, one of my mantras I lived by was to know oneself is to know God. And those sayings hit me hard because what it told me was I have to know what I can and can't do. I have to know what I'm capable of, what I'm not capable of, you know, in philosophy, there's a philosophy that says not everybody can walk on the moon, you know, we'll have to understand our place in life. And I think you get it. That doesn't mean you have to settle for it. That means, you know, I got to change that, you know? And a lot of people do that. A lot of people in our industry will get mad at the booker. They'll get mad at the club owner. You know, why aren't you booking me? You know, I thought it was funny one time a club owner showed me the emails he got from comics who didn't give work to. He's like, hey, you had Bill Joe over there and I'm funnier than him. You know, it's like, why would you? You know, that's not how you get work, man. You know,
well, it is a business. Like, I like that. I think that gets dismissed. In other words, you know, when we first start off in comedy, they have these bringer shows. They want people who are going to bring people out. You'll get some stage time because you can bring people out. And then people get to a place where they're like, I'm not a bringer, but I'm like, it's always a bringer show. You're not a comedian. Like, you have to be able to make the club money at some point. I know some comedians who think it's about what the club can do for them. But it's always a bringer show. Kevin Hart is a bringer show. He works arenas or Frank Sinatra. I mean, it's always a bringer show. It's never just about your comedy. And I think because that goes back to that point, it's a business. And if you're not making the club money based on your name, then you're only bringing a little bit to the table.
I've always thought it's so funny that we went on strike, as you know from the book. In 1979, the comedians went on strike at the comedy store because the comedy store was making millions of dollars a year. They had several clubs, and the comedians got zero, didn't make a dime. So the comics formed. It's all in the book. But anyhow, after it was over, after 8 weeks of just horror, you know, we got $25 a set. The comedians got $25 a set, and the improvisation did the same thing. Today, I think they're paying $12.50 And I think the Improv is paying $7.50, but they went backwards.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
They're doing bringers, and I've always thought, let me see, a bringer. Okay, so like there was a woman that worked at Ralph's. She was a cashier, and she was at Ralph's Grocery Market, and she was a nice woman. Everybody liked her. My daughter worked with her, and she said, "Dad, Juanita's booked at the Comedy Store." I said, "She is. You just told me she just started 2 weeks ago." I said, "She's booked at the Comedy Store?" Well, I didn't know what bringers were in those days. Well, she knew so many people from the grocery store. She packed the main room, you know, packed the main room, and went up on her lines so bad that people were shouting out, "Tell us about your mom," you know, because they were hurting for her, you know. But but I thought about it. I said, let's say the club says to you, "Okay, bring us 20 people. It's $20 at the door." Okay, that's $400 a club rate. And then they got to have drinks, 2-drink minimum. So you're saying to the club, "I'm going to give you $750 so I can work your club."
Yeah. What do you want to write the check to?
Whoa. Whoa. How far we've turned around, you know, and the club owner doesn't care that you bomb, you know, because they're making $700, you know, between the drinks and the
door. Well, that is happening because YouTubers, so there are people who are having success on YouTube. They're making YouTube videos, which is a very different art than stand-up. Stand-up comedy is not the same as performing on a video. And what happens is those YouTubers were getting, you know, 50,000 followers or 1 million followers. And then they call the comedy club and say, "Hey, we can come. And they're going to sell out." And the comedy club doesn't care that they put on a terrible stand-up show and that it was crap. All they cared about that the seats were full. That's something. Well,
business. Yeah. I mean, it's a business.
It's
and
a
when
business.
You realize, don't take it personal. You know, I hate to make this an analogy, but in the mafia, you know, in The Godfather, they had to kill Abe Vigoda, Tessio. They said, "It's business, Tessio. Don't take it personal. But we got to whack you."
Yeah. You can't take anything in comedy personal, right? Oh, my gosh.
By the way, we are here with Tom Dreesen on the Wake Up Late with Dougie show, who's had his new book out, still standing on Amazon. You got to check it out. Again, it's gotten me to read, and I haven't read in since college. One of the things interesting stories was in the beginning, your first real comedy gig was a duo, which was the first interracial comedy duo with Tim Reed. And now Tim was the actor who was Venus Flytrap in WKRP.
Yeah, later on he became Venus Flytrap on WKRP. He was in a show called Sister Sister. He played the father.
Yep.
He was on Simon and Simon. I mean, he had many. He produced Never Been on Stage Ever in Our Life. And we went on stage for the first time together as America's first black and white comedy team. What happened was I was in a group called the JCs, a civic group, and they attacked the community's problems by doing projects trying to rectify the wrongs in the community. And they taught you how to chair a committee, how to serve on a committee, and how to set up subcommittees and so forth and so on. And anyhow, I wrote a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor, a concept that I had. And by the way, I want to go back and digress. At that time, I honestly was praying, saying, "God, what is it you think I'm supposed to be doing? I can't believe that this is what I'm supposed to be doing," but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was honestly praying. So anyhow, when I proposed this drug education program to the JCs to run it, I wanted them to sanction it, run it as a JC project. At a meeting one night, a new guy had joined the chapter, Tim Reed. He graduated from Norfolk State College. E.I. DuPont recruited him in Chicago as a marketing rep. And as vice president at the bank, he set up an account and he said, "Hey, you're new in the area," told him about the JCs and brought him to the first meeting. Now, this is where fate, he comes up to me afterward. He said, "I'd like to work with you on that project. I'm a new member." I said, "Gee, I'm sorry. I already got a guy. I had a white friend named John DeBoer." The next day, John DeBoer calls me and said, "I can't do that with you. I got a new job." And I said, "Gee, what was that black guy's name?" Now, Tim Reed and I get together. We rehearsed the program. We went in the school system. And the moment we walked in that classroom, I went, "Oh, my God. What a blessing this guy is," because the children were black and white. The schools were integrated. And so Tim and I, we were young guys. When we walked in the classroom, we got their attention right away. And we would joke off of one another and getting the kids laughing. The program became number one in 50 states and in 22 foreign countries through JC Publications, that they use it as a model program on how to teach drug education at an elementary school level. They weren't teaching drug education at a college or a high school level in those days, let alone elementary school level. But I wanted to get to them early. But anyhow, one day after, you know, we were joking off of one another, we would plant the seeds of ills of drug abuse. One day, a little eighth grade girl leaving the classroom said, "You guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team." And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us. No one had ever done that before.
Yeah.
You know? And so we started writing what we thought was material. We bombed and bombed. And there were no comedy clubs in those days. You know, none. There was no open mics and stuff like that. We ended up working all black clubs in the North and the South, what they affectionately call the Chitlin Circuit, black-owned, black-operated nightclubs. And we worked all white nightclubs, so we ended up being on the Playboy Circuit. But, you know, we paid dues. We paid dues that no comedy team ever had to pay. Fourth time on stage, a guy put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face.
Oh.
And then tried to beat the bejesus out of me. And I told you I boxed on us in service, but this guy weighed like 100 pounds more than me. He almost crushed my ribs. It's a long story. It's in the book, all that, you know. But we paid a lot of dues. A guy hit me in the face with an ice ball at University of Illinois. You know, there's only about 5%, 95% of the people like what we did. The interesting thing about racism in those days, if there was a black guy who hated white people, hated them with a passion, he wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Tim for being with me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if there was a white guy, a redneck who hated black people, he wasn't mad at Tim. He's mad at me for being with Tim. And you know. I had some skirmishes, and there's some real incidents that happened in those days, you know, because I'm Irish-Italian, so I got this, you know, I got this temper that I have to keep. That's why I started reading positive mental attitude books, because I wanted the control of me, you know.
Tame the shrew. Yeah. I thought, you know, I have I am in an interracial comedy team myself. We're called the Ebony and Olive Comedy Tour. I am the olive. So we thought that was funny, but the same thing. My buddy Chris Priester and I do this, and it's like, in this time of racial divide, let's bring people together through laughter. What it's all about. You know, you one of the great stories about that, when you were your first show, and there's a story in the book, the first show, how somebody heckled you when you walked out.
Yeah,
and you had the balls to drop the guy. First, I should say this. I guess you're probably a much better storyteller of this. But the balls for you, and the bravery, and that you have to have that as a comic. You can't hold back, and you came out and said something that I guess even Tim said he couldn't believe he fucking said it. But what a great moment! I mean, that to me, if I was in that audience and witnessed that, even if I was black, I would have said, "Man, this guy," you know what I mean? You have to have respect for this guy for what he just said.
Well, because it was, and I would love for the people reading the book. I don't want to go through it all now because it's too long, but they would have to know that it was such an honest reaction to that moment. You know, that if I would have done it any other way, they would have said, "Oh, this guy's full of it. This guy's full of it." You know, if I'd have been, you know, patronizing or condescending, I just came out with it. You know, later I thought, you know, my heart was beating, you know, but it was a great answer for the, you know, but again, it was different times. It's so hard to describe what it was like touring clubs in those days, you know. You know, think about this. In nightclubs in those days, you opened on a Monday and closed on a Saturday night. You know, when we worked the Chitlin Circuit, there was a Sugar Shack in Boston, the 20 grand in Detroit. Motown was in Detroit in those days. So all the Motown acts broke the singers broke their acts in before they went to Vegas. They broke them in at the 20 grand. Now, Tim and I were in Detroit. We worked Sugar Shack in Boston, the 20 grand in Detroit, the High Chaparral in Chicago, the Burning Spear. But when you got to the Club Harlem in Atlantic City, that was before they had gambling. That was before the casinos ever there. The Club Harlem was on Kentucky Avenue. Opening nights were always Monday until Saturday. At the Club Harlem, you opened on a Saturday night and closed on the following Friday. Opening night, first show, 10 o'clock at night. Second show, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Third show, 6 a.m. They called it Sunday morning. they called it the breakfast show. And that show had 1,350 people jam those rooms. They came from all the waiters, the bartenders, the night people all came there. But all the pimps and the hoes from Newark, from Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, Manhattan, all the pimps brought their ladies down in Cadillacs and Rolls Royces, you know, for a good weekend job. And they, you know, they snorted cocaine off the table. And it was the rowdiest, but great audience. I can't tell you what it was like to kill that crowd.
Well, yeah, I bet.
The crowd. It was
when I read that part of the story, I could just from your, again, it was great reading it, because like you said, it's almost like I'm listening to you just tell the story, and it was just great. And you know, I was picturing this audience, because as a comic too, you know, as a white comic, we challenge ourselves by performing in an urban room. You want to make sure, like. Jen knows this. I spent the last several years just touring the country. not because I was making a lot of money, especially as an opening act and featuring a lot of different places, but because I wanted to get a grasp of the variety of audiences. I wanted to make sure my test my material, you know, and no better way than to test your material. And it was interesting how that was how you got started. And then it became the point for you to do your own thing.
I have an album out in front of an all black audience called That White Boy Is Crazy. And I did that. I'm the only comedian ever to do an album in front of an all black audience. And people, you know why? Because I'd go on to Tonight Show and I'd be talking about, I grew up in a black neighborhood. I played basketball on an all black basketball team. I played football on an all black football team. And I'd be doing routines about this. And white people would say, do black people laugh at your material? Do black people laugh at your material? I got so tired of it. I went and did an album. And every time they could say, do black people laugh at your material? I'd whip it out and say, give me $12.99. Here's a CD. You can go home and find out for yourself, you know. But whenever people would say to me, were you afraid? Or your all black audience, weren't you afraid? I always say, what color is laughter?
Yeah.
What color is laughter?
No, I grew up in Baltimore. I was born and raised in Baltimore. So I find that is how you connect with an audience, by just not thinking anything of it. Some people get intimidated going into a black room, but I've grew up around black people. Best thing that ever happened to me. You know,
there's a total difference between black audiences and white audiences in my day.
Absolutely.
Black audiences would talk back at you. You know, you'd go out there and, you know, and you'd say, it'd be like the Amen Corner in church to them. You know, say, I just got in from St. Louis. My brother lives in St. Louis. You know, you know, they would talk about you, and you have to learn off the roll off of that. You know, look out now. Oh, don't go there now, brother. You know,
I love that. When people verbalize instead of laughing, go, that's funny. That's funny. Like, yes, it is.
I know. I do a whole routine about that too, you know, about black audiences and white audiences.
You were in some movies as well. Spaceballs, one of the funniest movies I've known. Great Mel Brooks. I was about to say Mel Gibson. That's a different person entirely. WKRP in Cincinnati did a role in there, which was what a great TV show that was. I remember seeing that. And I guess you played the role of a comedian on Man in the Moon, the movie regarding Andy Kaufman.
I did myself.
Yeah. And because he was wasn't Andy around that time when you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I met Andy. Elaine Boozer called me from New York one time and she said, Tom, my friend Andy Kaufman, he was new then, is coming out to the West Coast. Will you befriend him? Because he's real shy. He's real painful. He's painfully shy. Would you, you know, include them? Like if you're going to Cantor's, like we've done. And so I did. I tried. Andy, he was out in the field though. I remember one time he was on a show called Days. The whole thing was that he was Jewish and that he was dating a Catholic girl. That was supposed to be the riff there, that they might get married and on. And I was sitting around him. I said, Andy, you know what you ought to do? I said, you ought to, on the show, get married on the show, on that show Fridays, you and the girl get married. I said, but what you do is, your Jewish family comes there and then her Catholic family comes there. And, you know, when they get to the point where, is there anyone here that doesn't want to see this marriage, speak now or forever hold your peace? And I said, you know, maybe the Catholic one said, I don't think that she should marry a Jew. I just don't think it's right. And then somebody on the other side said, I don't think you've got any business, and I want you to keep your mouth. I said, don't tell me to keep my mouth. I said, and pretty soon they're all beating each other, throwing fists and punching. And I said, and they have a real Donnybrook. And he said to me, what's a Donnybrook? I said, well, you ever watch baseball when both benches empty and they're in the middle of the field? That's a Donnybrook. I said, now they're all fighting, and then now the cake is there, and you're smashing. And it becomes, he goes, wow, you're not going to use that, are you? I said, what? He said, can I have that? I said, yeah. You can have that. You know, you wouldn't know if I was going to use that. You know. But he just was, you know, it's hard to describe him. When he became Tony Clifton, that's who he was. And you couldn't say to him, hey, Andy, how you doing? Because he was doing Tony. And he would come to the improv some nights as Tony. And you know, if you said, hey, Andy, you know, he'd walk out because you broke his character. You know, so we all had to be careful, you know. He was a sweet, sweet, sweet soul of a guy.
Yeah. How can you not forget that moment? I think it was on Carson when he comes out with the record player and does the Minnie Mouse or the Mighty Mouse song, you know, and he would just sit there. I remember he came out one time. He didn't even do that. He didn't say anything. I don't know if it was Saturday Night Live or what it was. He didn't do anything. He just sat there and just.
And like, he's so special.
He didn't say a word. He'd act like he's about to say something. And you would laugh because that person, that's powerful. When somebody's mere presence, you know, makes you laugh. Well,
you know, to have that, take a risk, to risk like that. Good actors risk in the scene, you know, and stand-up comedians. There was no one better than Robin Williams. They tried to compare him to Jonathan, and I love Jonathan Winters, and I knew Jonathan, but Robin was the risk. Robin would go to places that no human being would dare go with his comedy, and he'd find something in there. You know, he was just brilliant at that. But the taking a chance, I remember at Carnegie Hall, Andy is doing his stand-up, and now he does these silly things. He's singing a Gene Autry song or something. I'm back in the saddle again, and the orchestra's playing. Out where a friend, there's a friend, where the longhorn cattle graze. And he looks and he goes, there's a woman singing with me here. Ma'am, I don't need any help. You know, I don't need any help. Now, the woman's like 85 years old. You keep singing along with me. And she said, well, I'm a big fan of Gene Autry, and I always loved his movies. Oh, yeah, you love his movies. So, and you like singing his songs? Well, have you ever sung at Carnegie Hall? And other people, come on up here. Now, he brings this 85-year-old up again. And he said, go ahead. You want to sing? You want to interrupt me? Go ahead and sing. So now he's going to conduct the orchestra, and he gets that mean look on his face. And he goes, now he's going fast. Back in the saddle again. Now she's trying to keep it. I'm back in the saddle again. Oh, we're a friend. There's a friend. We're the long-run cattle great. Now she's gasping for air, and he's going fast and fast. And I'm back in the saddle again. And she goes, and falls over. Oh. Now people go, oh, my God. Oh, my God. She's laying there. Oh, my God. Now, they say, what's wrong? Now, some people come from stage right, like paramedics, and they got this electric thing in her, like in the chest, and the legs are kicking. And they go, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Now they close the curtain, and you're, woo, 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 woo. Sirens coming to Emma. People go, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Moments later, the curtain opens up, and Andy and this woman are dancing. They're dancing. This 85-year-old woman. And you know what? The New York Times called him the Son of Sam of comedy, you know, because, oh, you know, Son of Sam was his murderer. And because he wasn't afraid to fail. He would do crazy shit. Sometimes I would say, you know, Andy, I don't get that. I mean, you've gone somewhere here where I don't. But that's what he didn't care whether you liked him or not. What he cared was there was no reaction. You know, great actors will tell you that the worst thing can ever happen to an actor is after the play is over, they walk outside and they felt nothing.
Yeah.
They didn't feel rage, anger, happiness. They felt nothing. So Andy wanted you to feel something. And you know, that's by the way, the movie Spaceballs, you know, I got that role in that movie. I just got a divorce and I'm dating this beautiful girl, big, tall girl. It's our first date. I'm in a restaurant in Santa Monica, California. And I go to the bar, we're waiting for a table. And I sat down and she's tall and she stayed up. And Mel Brooks was in the restaurant and he saw her. He didn't see me, and he walked all the way around. He went because she was so pretty, and then he saw me, and I said, "Oh, hey, Mel, how you doing?" Because I had met him before. I said, hey, "Mel, how you doing?" I said, "This is my friend Trish. Her name was Trish," and he and she were talking, and she was excited about me and Mel Brooks, of course. But he said to me, "Hey, Dreesen, what are you doing Monday?" This was on a weekend. I said, "What do you want me to do Monday?" Yeah. He said, well, I got a movie. He said, I got a movie. I said, I'll do it. He said, wait a minute. I didn't even explain it to you. I said, I don't care. I'll do it. He said, it's a small part. I said, I don't care. I'll do it. Are you kidding me? I'll do it. Anyhow, it was filming 2 days. And as you know, they killed me with a can of shaving cream in the movie.
Yes.
But what happened in that movie, they had set the shaving cream like on a ledge. And it was supposed to be shaving cream. It's whipped cream. You know, the lead, and I forgot his name, he comes in and I'm a guard. And I go, wait a minute, you're not so-and-so. And I'm hollering at him. And I'm going, guards, guards. And he takes his ring, draws the shaving cream to himself, and he sprays it in my mouth, and I die. But it's whipped cream. But it's set in the window, and it's sour. Ugh. When he hit me with that, I hit the floor, and they're still rolling camera, and I'm about to die. And I'm laying there, and when Mel went cut, I bolted for the bathroom. I got my head in the toilet. You know?
Oh.
Mel came in there. Mel said, "Hey, Drieson, are you all right?" He thought I was nervous about the scene or something. I said, "Mel, what the F was in that can?" And he went, "Oh, geez." He said, "Sour." You know, we had to do the scene a couple more times. I have to tell you, I was really, you know, I got to, sitting around with Mel Brooks and Kyle Reiner, they tell stories that are just beyond funny. But many years ago, I played poker with Larry Gelbart. You remember who Larry Gelbart was? He wrote the movie Tootsie, and he wrote the movie, he wrote MASH. Larry Gelbart also was on the Show of Shows years ago. The writers were Woody Allen, Neil Simon, Kyle Reiner, Larry Gelbart, Mel Brooks. That's who the writers were on that show, the Sid Caesar show. Larry Gelbart told me, he said, when Mel Brooks had the producers on Broadway, when the movie The Producers first came out, not the movie, when the play, he said, after act one, they were in the lobby. And he said, a guy came out after act one, he walked right up to Mel Brooks and he said, "I don't like this play. I think this play stinks." He said, "Because you're glorifying Adolf Hitler. And I can't handle that." He said, "I'm a World War II veteran." And Mel Brooks said, "I was in World War II. I never saw you."
Oh my God.
Are you from Jersey? I'm from Jersey.
I don't remember you from Jersey.
I mean, yeah, if Mel Brooks says, "What are you doing tomorrow?" I'm whatever you want. I mean, come on. I mean, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. Funniest Blazing Saddles still to this day, timeless. Although you couldn't do half that stuff from Blazing Saddles, can you, anymore?
No, you sure can't.
That brings up a good point. You can do whatever you want to do. We have the First Amendment. What really pisses me off, the cancel culture and politically correct, just piss me off to no end. You know what I say to me whenever they say, "Well, you know, you can't say that." I said, "Well, go tell Dave Chappelle that. He's my hero. Go tell Dave Chappelle that. Tell Dave Chappelle, a minority, that he can't do that, and he'll tell you where you can stick it, where the sun doesn't shine. You know, you'd come to me, but you won't go to him, you know, because he'll tell you, that, you know, because first of all, when you put a comedian in a box, they're no longer a comedian. And look at my hands. If I say, by the way, Jen, go on stage and don't say this and don't say that. And by the way, don't say this and don't say that. And I just put you in a box. And once I put you in a box, you're no longer a stand-up comedian. You know,
and they're doing that. I mean, it's, and the audiences are doing that to us. That's what I don't get. I'm like, you came to a comedy show. You came here to see comedy. I mean, with the audiences are putting us in a box.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're coming out of these colleges where they're telling them, you know, they're telling them that you can't see this. I always tell them, when they can control what you say, look out, because the next step is they're going to control what you think. You know, they're going to go there. That's socialism. Socialism, and socialism leads to communism, and communism leads to, we'll tell you what to think. We'll tell you what you do every day. And when you stifle the stand-up comedian, Lenny Bruce went to jail for that. You know, when you stifle the stand-up comedian, if they ever stifle Dave Chappelle, that's all over in stand-up comedy.
Boy, he came out with his last special, and he just threw political correctness right. He punched it right in the face, you know, with the things he said, you know, and that special, which you got to be able to do that. Like you said, you can say these things, but you can't do it like, you know, when you're at that Club Harlem. If you're going to say it, you have to do it. You can't hold back. You know, I got some advice from a comic this weekend I work with, because I tell a joke. It's a reference to wet vac and the word play with wet vac and wetback. And he says, "No, man, don't sugarcoat it. You come out and say what you want, because unless you mean to be, if you mean harm, then you're going to be a little reluctant. Right. You sugarcoat it. But if you come out and just say it and it's funny, then people will guess it is funny, and it's not your personal belief."
You know what Will Rogers said about that? Will Rogers said, "If there's no malice in your heart, there's no malice in your jokes." Yeah. I think that's his, you know.
That says it all. Yeah. You know, you mentioned Robin Williams, and I just had a conversation with somebody here. It was weird because I had a conversation a day or two after reading in the book your story about him. But, you know, he was known as a joke thief. You know, he was known, and, you know, and stuff like that. I have friends that talk about other people, even like Eddie Murphy. You know, Eddie Murphy stole some jokes. His I think it was his Mr. Rogers gig was somebody else's gig in New York that he actually just didn't. That somebody said, "Hey, Eddie Murphy just did your gig on TV," you know, and he's like, "Oh," but you had a great, you know, you had a great point in there. But Robin Williams was the kind of guy, if he did your joke, he did it better than you. And you're like, what are you going to do? You know?
Robin could take a germ of a joke that's just a mediocre joke and turn it into a 4-minute routine or a 5-minute routine. He was brilliant. He just was his genius. You know, he was my opening act. I did like 2 Tonight shows, and I worked at a place called Laugh Stop in Newport Beach. A guy named Michael Kelly owned the place. And I was a headliner, and my opening acts were Roger and Roger, a comedy team, Willie Tyler and Lester, a black guy with a puppet.
Puppet, you know? Yeah. Remember him.
And then a new kid named Robin Williams. And when I got there, I said to the guy, Robin Williams, what does she do? He said, no, it's not a girl, it's a guy. And he's from San Francisco. I said, oh, no kidding. And he did 15 minutes. He was the opening act. I looked at him and I went, oh, my God, what planet did this guy come from? Unbelievable. And we were friends ever since. I love Robin. He was the sweetest, kindest gentleman you ever met in your life. I never heard him say a bad word about anybody. He was tortured, though. His genius tortured him, you know. Mm-hmm. And he got into cocaine for a while, and then he got off of that, and he just was tortured. I mean, you look at some of his films. I mean, this guy was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
No one thought he could act like that. I mean, his acting, you know, and that to me is always just amazing when somebody could be that multifaceted, you know, be funny and then be an actor and then sing. And I mean, you know, just that kind of stuff is awing, you know, when you see that.
Doug, you know, this guy would go to the comedy store and jump up when he's a star, and he'd do like 30, 35 minutes. He'd let him go whatever. He'd leave there and go over to improv 35 minutes. And he'd leave there and he'd go over to a comedy magic club and leave there and go to another. He would do 10 or 12 places a night. And I think he was doing a lot of blow in those days too, but he just could not get enough. And you know, his brain was a sponge. It would absorb. He would see other comedians working, you know, and he would absorb some of the material. But it would come out where you wouldn't even recognize it was your material, you know. he was brilliant.
That was a genius. You know, and of course, one of the greatest of all times, Frank Sinatra, who, you know, like I said, you got to open for, you know, Sammy Davis Jr., you know, I mean, great, these performers. The thing that was amazing to me as an opening act, you were doing it for singing and music acts, you know, so you were the comic. You were the opening act for a star, but these were, you know, a different level of entertainer. There were singers, there were this and that, but you were the comic. And like you said, so if somebody says, hey, you're an opening act. No, you were the comic on a head show, like, you know, and, you know, I read this stuff, by the way, and, you know, because as an opening act, you have a certain thing. Like, and Jen mentioned something earlier, I've worked for people and they'd be like, hey, because I mean, when you had Robin Williams opening for you, you know, it's not like you would go to Robin Williams and go, hey, Robin, you mind toning it down a little bit? You know, I don't want to work so freaking hard. You know, I mean, you never said that to him.
No, but you know what? There's a certain, I was going to write a book at one time called Opening Act, because I had opened for some of the biggest names in show business, Dean Martin and Sammy Davis and Frank. And there's a certain responsibility that opening act has. You got to get that audience up for this guy. You got to get that audience up for them, or they're not going to keep you, you know, and you can't insult his audience or her audience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of women too, as singers, but there's a certain responsibility. And what I always do, I was doing Tonight shows, I was doing Merv Griffin, Dinah Shore, Mike Douglas, Johnny Carson, Midnight Special, Rock Concert, Soul Train, American Bandstand. I was doing, you know, Hollywood Squares and $20,000 payment. I was away doing a lot of stuff. But when I opened for them, I would say to them, how much time do you want me to do? Is there anything you don't want me to, area you don't want me to touch? This is your audience. They paid to see him, and I got to get them up for you. How much time? And I said to Sammy Davis, how do you want me to dress? He said, I think you should dress at least as good as the people that see us. And in those days in Vegas, the dinner show, you wore a jacket, you know, and then the second show, you could dress more casual. You wore a suit and tie. You could dress more casual. But there were certain responsibilities to an opening act, and that you had to, you know, saying that. I said to Frank Sinatra one time, why do we wear tuxedos? We wore tuxedos wherever we went, except closing night in Vegas or Reno or Atlantic City. And the closing night, we wore a suit because we bolted out of there, got on the jet. But I said to Frank, why do we wear tuxedos? He said, Tommy, if we're going to do a show for the king and the queen, royalty, would we wear a tuxedo? I said, yeah. He said, well, that garage mechanic from Detroit and his wife, who's a waitress, who worked all year long to get enough money to buy 2 tickets to our show, They're just as much royalty as a king and a queen. We right. dress for them the same way we dress for the king and the queen. I thought, but again, it's his show and I'm the opening act. You got to get it. I want to tell you something interesting. I'll say to you, Jen, or you, Dougie, this is what it was like opening for Frank Sinatra. Now, I had, before I opened for Frank, I opened for Sammy in front of 3,500 people and, you know, in the round and stuff like that, but 20,000. The first place we went was Nassau Coliseum. So I'd say to you, it's 5 minutes before you go on. Now, you're in the round. You're in the center of a big arena. I'd say, you know, Jen, listen, I want you to go out there. And for the next 45 minutes, there's 20,000 people out there. For the next 45 minutes, I want you to hold their attention. Oh, one more thing, Jen. I want you to hold their attention. But I want you to make them laugh for the next 45 minutes. Oh, one more thing, Jen. I want you to hold their attention and make them laugh. But I want you to make them laugh when you want them to laugh. I want you to pull the strings on the emotions of 20,000 people. No props, no tricks, no charts, no special arrangement, no special lighting, no orchestra, nothing. But you and 20,000 people. And one more thing, Jen. Not one of them came to see you.
<That's a feeling.
laughs> And then you go, gulp.
Right, I'm like, where's the bathroom? Didn't you show me where the bathroom is?
but I tell you what I used to do. And I talk to other comics, when you work in a big arena and you're opening for a guy like Frank, I'd walk out there. You know, first of all, the arena would go dark and everybody go, whoa. And the orchestra was in the pit and they go, bam, 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 bam. Everybody go, ah. They think Frank is coming out, you know. And they say, ladies and gentlemen, the comedy star of our show, Tom Gleason. And you go, oh, you know, as you're walking to the stage. And it, fortunately, I had done a lot of television in those days, so I did have some recognition. But still, they came to see Frank. So my opening line, you never go out in an audience that size and with your A material. Not then. I'd walk out and I'd say, how many of you out there applaud now? How many of you out there thought Frank Sinatra was coming out? And they'd applaud. I'd say, I know just how you feel. I'm a little bit disappointed myself, you know. Now, the joke is on me, right? But here's what I'd use this all the time. I'd say, how many of you out there are in this arena for your very first time? Applaud. I didn't say raise your hand. I said applaud. I talk and you react. I talk and you react. I'd say, how many of you out there are in this arena for your very first time? Applaud. And they'd applaud. I'd say, how many of you out there are seeing Frank Sinatra live your very first time? Applaud. And they'd applaud. See, how many of you out there aren't wearing any underwear? Applaud, and they'd applaud. I'm throwing away this material because I talk and you react. I talk and you react. I'm in the round, so I'm going all over. When you work arena with 20,000 people, about 3,000 are trying to find their seats at the same time when you're going out. You know, so all of that was to get their attention. I talk, you react. Notice I didn't say raise your hand. I said applaud. So then after I do a couple jokes, local jokes about the local area that I'd write, you know, that night. And before I come in, or if I could find out some stuff about the area. So I'd have, and then I went into my A material. Now I got them. The focus is on me up here. But it's a task because, again, they didn't come to see you, you know.
How long would that generally take? I mean, you're doing 45 minutes, and, you know, and so how long would it take for you to do that?
It'd take about 5 minutes. I mean, because you had a boom, bang, boom, bang. You're drawing their attention to you, you know, and you're telling them, I talk and you react. You know, I'd go this side of the arena and that side of the arena and behind me. And I talk to those people up there, you know, applaud, you know, again, I talk and you react. I'm bringing the focus to me because otherwise they're all over the place, you know.
That's amazing. You said that many people, that there's still 3,000 people meandering through this place.
Oh, God. You know, of course, the traffic, like you're in New York or Chicago, traffic and then parking and then, you know, all the other things that would delay them, you know. But Frank, you know, for about 2 years, Frank had Buddy Rich to go on tour with us, and Buddy would go first. He'd do like 30 minutes. I love that. Because when I walked out now, Buddy Rich playing for, you know, 30, 35 minutes, and he had him, on the, you know, with all that stuff. And then I'd walk out on top, that having Buddy open for you, you know, and he was pissed. He didn't like that at all. He used to say to Frank, let the kid go on first. Let the kid, you know. And Frank would say, no, he said, I want comedy before me, not music, you know.
That's, you know, Buddy Rich to this day, as I could remember, out of all the drummer, he's the only drummer I ever saw perform on a Tonight Show. Or, you know, you didn't have Neil Peart from Rush, who was a great drummer. You know, you didn't have Stuart Copeland from the Police. You know, he would show up and just play the drums.
Just be the show star with his drums.
Well, by the way, I've asked drummers all over the world. I asked Irv Cotler, Frank Sinatra's drummer. I asked all drummers. I'd say, who's the greatest drummer of all? And they'd all say, oh, Tommy. Oh, gee, Tommy, there's drummers here, and then there's Buddy Rich. He said, there's no comparison. He said, Buddy Rich, when he was 18 months old, you know, he was doing licks. It was like a genie head. He said, drummers would go watch Buddy Rich, and he'd be doing something, blah, 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 and they'd look at it and say, you can't do that. Did you see what he just said? You can't do that. You know, he was head and shoulders above any drummer that ever lived. You know?
Yeah, flam a little, trill, trill, trill. I tried drumming once. I was horrible.
I've only dated drummers. I've never actually.
you date the drummers?
I've dated one or two.
They say they're the crazy ones. They're the wild ones.
Jen took it serious. Jen took it serious when they said, give the drummer some. You know. By the way, you know, my favorite joke about that, at the Little Bighorn, you know, John Custer, night before Little Bighorn, he's sitting around with his men around the campfire, and they hear boom, 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 boom.
Mm-hmm.
And General Custer said, I don't like the sound of them drums. And an Indian came over the hill and he said, he's not our regular drummer.
He's filling in. That's awesome. You know, it had to be one of the things I read too. We're reading the book, working for him. You talk about the stress of a comic, you know, just the pressures of having to make sure you keep your job, and are the crowds happy or are they not happy? But then to work for somebody like Frank Sinatra, you know, and everything that was around there, the competition, you talk about it in the story, in the book a bit, but the competition alone, you know, to be in that spot must be like, you wake up every morning, like thinking, oh my God, you know, I hope I keep my job, you know, and it's had to be pressure.
I got to tell you what, you know, before I met Frank Sinatra, I did like 30 or 40 appearances on the Tonight Show. I toured with Sammy and all the other, I was doing the Dean Martin roast. And so I was working all the time. When I first met Frank, I thought I was only going to do 1 week with him. I was going to try to get my picture taken with him and hang it in every bar in Chicago, and that'd be it. The second night I was with him, he took me out to dinner, him and his wife. We were working the Golden Nugget in Atlantic City. He took me out to dinner. In the middle of the meal, I can remember like it was yesterday, he set his knife and his fork down, and he said, I like your material, and I like your style. I'd like you to do a few other dates with me if you're interested. And I didn't say, let me check my calendar. You know, I said, yeah. But now, I made up my mind, because Frank was volatile. And I'm Irish-Italian, and I'm half-Sicilian, and Frank was half-Sicilian, too. I knew that I saw him go off on some people every now and then. And I made up my mind that if he ever goes off on me, I'm just going to grab his hand and shake it and say, Frank, it's been great working with you. And I was going to leave, because I'm not going to be a whipping boy, as much as I love Frank Sinatra, by the way. And I was a huge fan. I'm not anybody's whipping boy. And I couldn't be that. It would embarrass me if somebody would talk to me condescending. Wow. And I stand up for myself, you know. So that day never came. That day never came. He said one time to a guy from the New York Times, the guy said, how come you keep Tom Dreesen with you all these years? He said, you mean besides the fact that he's funny? And the guy said, yeah, besides that fact. And Frank said, well, if I'm a saloon singer, and I am, then Tommy's a saloon comedian. By that, I mean, we're just a couple of neighborhood guys. And I always treasured that remark, because that's what I was, am, and always will be. And so was he. When we were alone in the car late at night riding around the desert, I was a kid from Harvey, Illinois, and he was a kid from Hoboken. And he wasn't the great Frank Sinatra, even though, you know, the reason I stayed with him all those years, he never knew how much in awe of him I was. I never let him see that side. You know how many times I wanted to say to him, Frank, when you did From Here to Eternity, that one scene, or Frank, when you did The Manchurian Candidate, or Frank, tonight, when you did My Way, whatever song, I'm like any other fan. I wanted to say, wow, you kicked him in the ass tonight. But I didn't do that. I said, good crowd tonight. I don't hate you. Yeah. They came to play tonight, and we changed the subject. I don't know what made me pick up on it, maybe being a bartender all those years, but I picked up on it that he didn't need another fan. He had millions of fans. He needed a pal.
A friend, know. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great lesson for comics, because that can happen. You end up working with somebody who you're in awe of, you know, somebody, and you're opening for them, and you don't want to be sitting in the green room like, oh, I you know, like you said, I really loved you in this movie, you know. You want to be a peer. You want to be somebody who's there with them, like you said. And I've worked with comics, and I've had comics show up, and they're just, you know. I remember one time I was working with Ahmed, very funny comic, and the guy, one of the guys we brought along was talking the guy's ear off, you know, like the whole time at the bar before the show. And I'm just, you know, just hanging out. And then Ahmed says to me after the show, he goes, "Hey man, where are you staying?" I go, "I got to drive back and forth. I don't have a hotel for this gig." He goes, "Well, stay with me at the condo, you know, just come and hang out with me." And I said, "Oh, that's awesome." He goes, "But don't bring that guy." Leave that guy home. So it, there's a lot of importance of being that, you know, being that's like music bands. You know, they say sometimes some of the greatest musicians don't stay together in a band because they're all great musicians because they all get along, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing too, when you travel in Frank Sinatra's circle, you know, I'd stay at his home and this is, he had this beautiful compound that had bungalows all around the outer perimeter. You know, they were called New York, Strangers Tonight, Tender Trap, My Way, named after his songs. But the house gets with Gregory Peck and his wife, Veronique, Kirk Douglas and his wife, Anne, Jack Lemmon and his wife, Felicia, Clint Eastwood and whoever he was dating that night, you know, at that time. It was Angie Dickinson and all these, you know, Admiral Shepard, the first man in space, and on the fifth lunar mission, landed on the moon, you know, all these guests. But when you were there, they treated you like a peer. I mean, the first time I went down there, I'm going, these are people I saw in the movies. These are people when I was growing up, you know, that you know, they were the big, these big stars, but they never acted like that. Hollywood is loaded with just spoiled brats who never really worked a day.
Oh boy. I think we lost Tom for a second.
Did we lose? He's looking frozen.
Yeah.
Give a minute for the connection to.
I was worried. I was a bit worried there too because there's, you know, the fires going on there and there's some power outages in California too. So hopefully we get him back because.
Yeah.
I hate to say goodbye. Well,
in the meanwhile, I would love to talk about my how happy I am to be here at the Artist House in Key West with my little buddy. Is this crazy? This little Robert the doll.
He looks haunted.
It is. It is haunted. So this was the house of Eugene Otto, an artist. And he lived in this house and he had this little doll that was made for him, I believe, by his mammy. And it was like a life-size doll with this little dog. And he had the same outfit. And they have a whole thing that Robert did it. Weird things would happen here at the Artist House. And they would say that Robert did it. And what happened is once Eugene left the house, when Eugene left the house, people would still see things happening and they would like see Robert the doll up in the window and move around. And so this place is super cool. If you're ever down in Key West, definitely come check out the Artist House. I do believe it's haunted. I believe I have experienced a haunting here, but man, it is. If you, the
like a bed
Key
breakfast.
West experience doesn't happen unless you're.
It's like a
unless you're here at the Artist House. I'm sorry.
It's like a bed and breakfast you can stay at.
Yeah. Oh, it's a bed and breakfast. Carlos and Jessica. I mean, it's like it's like staying at home with family and it, like, yeah, it's just the hospitality is unbelievable. And we're right downtown. I mean, we have bikes and we're just biking around Key West and coming back to the room. And it's just fantastic.
If you're gonna stay in Key West, you got to stay on Duval Street. I mean, you know what I mean? You know, why bother being somewhere else? You got to stay there and walk and get drunk and come back. And
yeah,
that's the only way to go down to Key West.
It's fantastic. We come back here all the time. And so, and they were nice enough to let us, I mean, I'm in the middle here. Like we're doing the podcast right here in the welcome room. But cool. I know, I can't believe did we lose Tom? Is that.
Yeah, Brad, were we able to get him back? Yeah, we may have lost him because we're over an hour anyway. So. Would have been good to say, you know, goodbye in a proper way. But listen, I'm going to tell you guys this. Like I said, I have enjoyed reading this book. I got like two chapters left. But, I mean, there are stories in here. I didn't want to give away. But there's just story after story. And if you're a comedian, too, a lot of our comedians listen to the show, watch the show. Just a great book read. You know, 280-something pages. And if you're into entertainment and knowing more about Sinatra and Davis, there's just these little stories. You know, David Letterman wrote the foreword for the book, which is always interesting. And I was going to ask him a couple questions about David Letterman as well. But that's how it works in this modern day society where Zooming in is our way to connect.
Yeah.
And that's the way it goes. So, well, we're not going to worry about Joke Right tonight. This is just a different show. And we're right at the 9:20 hour. more or less here on the Danger Studios. And hey, Jen, this is our first show back together.
I know, it's so good to see you. I'm so glad you don't have COVID.
Yeah, anymore. And although when I was in Myrtle Beach all week, I was wearing my mask, you know, selling merch and stuff. And by the way, big shout out to Stephen Michael Azadars, who was, because I always going to screw his name, because from the Breaking Bad TV show, very funny guy.
And great to hang.
So like we were in a condo together all week, and it was just great hanging out, you know, bullshitting and stuff and getting to know somebody, you know, and I wasn't doing that. Oh, I loved you in Breaking Bad. Oh, you know, I was trying to keep my cool as well. But nevertheless. But yeah. So, hey, by the way, we're going to have another great show next week. I'm going to have Vince Cicere, who is an actor, comedian, martial artist, and Dustin Chafin, my buddy from New York, who runs the Greenwich Village Comedy Club, has a new album out. So we'll be back next week with all new shows here on the Wake Up Late with Dougie show. So I'm going to give Tom a call after we're done here to say thanks and everything. But get his book on Amazon. It's a great read, great story. Great story, by the way. I'm going to tease it with Johnny Carson, regarding Johnny Carson, Frank Sinatra, and Joey Gallo, the leader of all the mafia in New York. And it was just a story like, oh my, you know, you don't think this shit can happen. And you, wow, you know, this happened with these people. So just a great story. And Jen, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's good to see you. I look forward to catching up. Like I said, I'm going to enjoy the rest of my time here at the Artist House. And then next week I'll be at Stripes Pub and Grill in Navarre, Florida. So if anybody finds themselves in the panhandle, come check me out at Stripes.
Yeah, and a week from this Saturday, I'll be at Tim Finnegan's in Delray Beach headlining the David Sadman, who's becoming the Ringling Brothers of comedy.
I love him. Yeah.
So watch for more dates like that. But guys, don't forget to follow us, our show, on Twitter at Wake Up Dougie and our Instagram at Wake Up Dougie Show. Follow me at Dougie Dangerous on Instagram and on Twitter. Jen?
Yes, you can follow me on Instagram, Jen Hellman Media. And find me, Jennifer Hellman, on Facebook. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in tonight. That was a great show. That was a lot of fun. It was really interesting.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. Big thanks to, again, to Tom Driesen, who was on our show. And, again, very surprised he was going to do the show. I was, like, so glad we talked and we messaged back and forth about a couple other things in the past. And he says, I'll do it. I'm like, oh, my God, this is great. And I was actually nervous. I'm like, holy shit. Like,
we didn't even do the show. We didn't even do our normal show.
We'll save those stories for Joke Right next time, by the way. Anyway, guys, thanks again for joining us. God bless. Stay well. And make people laugh today or tomorrow if you have the possibility, right?
See you soon.
Thank you, Brad.
In the colors of a thousand sunsets, they travel to the world on a silvery light. The people of the earth stood waiting, watching as the ships came one by one. Setting fire to the sky as they landed, carrying to the world children of the sun. Children, I